I'm very pleased today to begin this, continue the Bible study for the book of James. I'm breaking in a new Bible and the pages are a bit sticky, so I have my trusty electronic Bible. One way or another, we're going to get through this. We're going to go through this one verse at a time. And now that means that if we're really, really lucky, we're going to get through chapter 1, verses 1 through 11 today, if it really works well. Okay, so there's two reasons for that. One, it's probably going to take longer than I thought. And number two, I'm hungry and I'm looking forward to the potluck. So let's start, if we do it, in James 1, in verse 1. And if we take a look at this book of James, we went through last time to learn the background of the book of James. It's a general epistle, meaning it's... And so when we read James 1, verse 1, it says, "To the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greetings." Well, let's break this down a little bit. Who are these 12 tribes? Well, it's telling us this is a general letter. It isn't a letter to a particular congregation. It isn't a letter to congregations that are in one particular city or province, but it's scattered out. Now, I read some interesting online observations, and people were writing back and forth. And one lady said, "These are to the 12 Jewish tribes that are scattered around." I'm thinking, apparently she could have perhaps studied a little harder to find out only one of the 12 tribes are Jewish. And so we have here in this time of ancient Israel, we have the tribe of Judah and Benjamin living in that land. But there are also the other tribes, the 12 tribes of Israel. Of course, the tribe of Joseph is the Joseph being the inheritor of that special blessing, had a double portion, and so he had two sons, and so there's two half-tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. So fundamentally, though, 12 tribes, which are scattered abroad. So this letter is meant to be written or read in a widespread manner to people that are not just in that area, but to a far distant area. Interesting that it's the number 12. If you go through the number of cases in the Bible where we read the number 12, it appears to be a number that's often used and associated with governance. I mean, it's not just the Old Testament tribes, as we've read about, of the sons of Jacob or the sons of Israel that we read about in Genesis and 49. But there were 12 men in the Temple of Solomon. There were 12 lions around Solomon's throne. There were 12 disciples. There's 12 baskets of food that was left over after feeding the 5,000. This number 12 we see in a number of places. The book of Revelation is full of the numbers of 12, 12 thrones, 12 gates of the city, and 12 messengers at the gate. So this 12 tribes the number 12 is common throughout the Bible. Then we take a look at, of course, we know the tribes, who the tribes are, the tribes of the children of Israel. And then we take a look at this term scattered abroad. If we take a look in Ezekiel 12, verses 15 and 16, we can read that these tribes were scattered out. In fact, I might want to just turn there, Ezekiel 12, 15 and 16. And we'll get there. So in Ezekiel 12, starting in verse 15, let's back up a little bit. "I will scatter to every wind all who are around him to help draw him and all his troops, and I will draw out the sword after him." He's talking about... we'll just read on. "Then they shall know that I am the Lord, and when I scatter them among the nations and disperse them throughout the countries, but I will spare a few of their men from the sword, from famine and pestilence, that they may declare all their abominations among the Gentiles wherever they go, that they shall know that I am the Lord their God." So there were many of the children of Israel that died, but many were preserved as an example that said, well, we're sending you out. You're going to be dispersed among the nations, among these tribes. As an example. If we back up, let's see, if we back up to, there we go. Back up to chapter 11, verse 16. Therefore, says the Lord God, although I have cast them off among the Gentiles, and although I have scattered them among the countries, yet I shall be a little sanctuary for them in the countries where they have gone. Therefore shall I say, I shall will gather you from the peoples, assemble you from the countries where you've been scattered, and I will give you the land of Israel. Now, this is some prophecy that is yet to come, and well, it's only been partially fulfilled. But there, we're talking about these tribes that are scattered, not just in that immediate area, but around the world. And we see that today when we see the evidence of the offspring of Israel scattered around the world. So we have these to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad. And at the time that James was writing this, the Roman Empire was extant, was ruling the area. Persecution was strong against those because of this whole among the Jews. The early Christians were almost all Jews. And so those who were Messianic Jews at the time faced a lot of persecution, not just from the Jews, but also from the Romans, because they were unusual. And so this was a very difficult time, and they couldn't always be together at one time, and they were somewhat forced to scatter so that they would not appear as a target. And then if we take a look at the last word in this phrase, to the 12 tribes which are scattered abroad, greetings. Well, this greetings, if we take a look at the actual translation, it's like joy or rejoice or to be cheerful or to hail. You know how it is when you see somebody you haven't seen for a while and you wave, hey, you know, like that. So it's a kind of conveys that sense or that meaning. So it's an uplifting kind of a greeting that's used there. So it's to those 12 tribes who are scattered abroad, you know, que pasa, or hey, how's it going? And so it's a very friendly, upbeat greeting. Then we read in verse 2, in James 1, verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Wow. So first of all, we have, that's kind of an upbeat a greeting. And then he calls them my brethren. Now, these are people that he may likely have never met. And yet James is calling them his brethren. And I went through and I counted, and there were 15 times where James uses the term in the New King James, where he uses the term brethren. In other words, it's a very close relationship. It's not, I am the master and you are the servant kind of relationship. It's not an authoritarian mindset that he's coming across. He's treating them as peers, as it were, as equals. In other words, it's not looking down. He's not looking up. He's looking across at them. So he says, my brethren. And then he says, count it all joy. Well, this idea looks to be a paradox. You know, like there's two different outcomes here with this same phrase, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. So how in the world can somebody be joyful? You know, you grab a handful of thistles thinking it's something else and you're pulling weeds in a garden, and that's not a particular joy. Or maybe poison ivy or something else that people have run into this last week doing the gardening in my family. At least, well, the men in my family, in my house. And so those are become particular trials, and they start out maybe little and they get bigger and bigger and can be a problem. Well, how in the world can you be joyful, or can it be even profitable when you come into this this phrase or expression? What we're looking at here is the development of human character. So when we read about this, the term, as it's termed in the New King James, it says trials. I believe in the King James Version, it says temptations. Christians are not immune from trials or temptations, difficulties or hardships, or because good people can suffer bad things. I remember in law school, one of the first things they tell the first year students, that bad things can happen to good people. And the law doesn't always have a remedy for this. In other words, you can't always be expected to be made whole or everything back the way it was. So those are time and chance things. Bad things can happen to good people. It isn't necessarily God who's testing us. Oftentimes, we allow ourselves to get into predicaments that cause ourselves to be tested. Because it's going to reveal what's really in our heart. And of course, we know in Jeremiah 17:9, our heart isn't always positive. So if we're going to, as it says here in James 1:2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials. If we're going to use the word count, it means to consider or to think of. Actually, the actual literal interpretation is to think of it as a joy. In other words, you don't want to, so he's explaining you have to make a decision here. You have to decide what good can come of this. Well, I'll tell you this much. When I grab a hold of a thistle, I can tell you what good's going to come. I'm sure not going to grab a hold of another one. Well, those are the easy ones. Those are the easy things in life. Learning to recognize poison ivy ought to be easy, right? And then don't do that again. Well, sometimes it's a little harder for us because we kind of do the same thing over and over again. As my dad has mentioned, he waited until I was over 40 years old when he mentioned, after I had made a mistake. When I was visiting on the farm, I was going to help him out with the project. And as a loving father did, and I've just wished he didn't wait so long, he said, you know, son, I don't mind if you make a mistake now and again. I just wish that you would keep making different ones. Well, this is kind of what we're seeing here in James 1 and 2, is that think of it as a joy. In other words, an opportunity that when you fall into various trials or temptations. The joy here means gladness or being joyful from Strong's 5479. These are the occasions for which there is to trigger some joy. In other words, you're going to have to look for it. You're going to have to make an effort to find that joy. Matthew Henry's commentary writes that philosophy may instruct men to be calm under their troubles, but Christianity teaches them to be joyful because such exercises proceed from the love of God. So each of us then is responsible for how we react to the trials that we encounter. And then James is going to go on to help us to learn how to react by helping us to learn wisdom. And the first thing we need to do is, first of all, recognize that there has to be a good outcome in the trial. There's going to be, you know, something positive. And if you look at it right that way, right from the beginning, as we do in verse 2, it's going to help our mindset or our attitude as we go through the book of James. In this case, a letter that he's written to the many people scattered abroad. In fact, it had to have had widespread distribution, all 12 tribes. I can only imagine that it would have gone, that letter would have circulated thousands of miles, perhaps, and taken quite a bit of time. Perhaps it was likely recopied so they could send the original along and recopy it and have it there. If we, and this is why I particularly liked Mr. Ken Martin, his sermon, because if we have a joyful spirit, we can look at our situation objectively and then grow from it. Because if we allow the circumstances to weigh us down and negatively affect our mindset, then our vision becomes blurred and then we're unable to deal objectively or fairly or correctly with it. So coming up with that positive attitude is very, very helpful. And then we can begin to show some of the other fruit, the spiritual fruit, as we learn and we grow. Now, there's also this word that says when we fall into various trials. Well, let's take a look at the word fall here. The Greek word for fall used in this context is parapitoperi, which means around. It means to signify to fall in with or to among or to light upon, to come across. We can see in Luke 10:30 when it talks the about the man who fell among robbers. In other words, it was something, an occasion that came out. It was something that occurred. It's Strong's 4045. Vine's dictionary defines it as to fall around. So to fall into temptation, it was a happenstance. And then we read this term into various trials. And generally speaking, we don't go seeking out temptations or trials. In fact, we try to avoid the hardships or the trials. We generally put in gas so our car can get wherever we want to go, so we don't take a chance. Hope my wife doesn't comment on that here for me. But we try to prevent those problems, you know, so that we don't run out of gas, or we don't that we've prepared ahead of time to avoid the hardship, and because we've kind of already gotten an idea. Now, when we are only 2 years old and we're a toddler, we're learning to walk, as Mr. Martin said on the sermon, you know, as a child riding a bike, they fall down and can get skinned up, just like a toddler is learning to walk, and they fall down. Have you ever seen a toddler who says, "That's it, I give up, I will never try this again. Crawling is good, and I'm going to stick with that, and when I'm 87 years old, I'll think about it, but until then, no, no." They're driven. People are driven, and so they're going to keep going at it. So even though people fall, they keep at it. Now, it's an important characteristic that the temptation to sin is not induced by God. This is something that we manage to do all on our own. We don't need any extra help. There's plenty of opportunity from the inherent nature of man and with Satan's nature around us, that we don't, and it would be inappropriate to think or to say that God causes us to sin. God will allow us to, so that we can learn lessons. So we are straying away from the truth if we say that God tempts people to sin. Because his attributes are love, which is really counter to sin, to moving against God's law. The King James Version of the Bible translates the word trials as diverse temptations. Or another translation would be manifold temptations, things that are evident. These tend to be trials that may have a beneficial purpose. So when you come out of it, there can be some benefit to us. In Matthew 24 or 26, verse 41, we are learned that we should watch and pray so that we don't enter into the temptations, meaning by carelessness or disobedience. That's probably where most of the trials come from, our carelessness or disobedience. Sometimes we make choices that we could have made better choices on that. And I have a son-in-law that made a remarkable statement one time, and it was going to cost him a goodly sum of money, a decision someone else had made, and a lot of time and aggravation. And he said something quite simple in a calm voice. He said, "Well, lesson learned." Now, I would have probably been peeling off the ceiling about that time, but he was very calm and collect about it. And I thought, what a marvelous approach, is because he saw the problem. It was staring him in the face. There were lots of negative consequences. It cost him time. It cost him money. But the first thing he thought of was, it's a lesson. This is considered a lesson learned. So if we can look at those, and James is telling us to consider this an opportunity to learn that lesson. Now, we want to take a look, too, at 1 Corinthians 10:13. In 1 Corinthians 10:13, this is probably one that we want to keep with us on a regular basis, because we're going to make much use of this. If I can pull it out, 1 Corinthians 10:13. 1 Corinthians 10:13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But it doesn't stop there. The verse continues on. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. That's a wow statement, because how many times do we fall into a temptation or a trial and we do not see a way out? We don't see any way that we can get past this. We're going to just take the hit and it's going to be ugly and there's nothing we can do. So do we give up? And yet this verse tells us that somewhere, even if we don't see it, with this temptation or with this trial, there will be a way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Now, someone showed me this verse years ago when I was at a time of very heavy trial and said, this, you know, look at this verse, you know, this, there is a way of escape that you may be able to bear it, because you can't be tempted beyond that which you will, beyond that which you'll be able to bear. And I thought, no, this is too heavy. I can't bear this. And yet God apparently thought I had greater capacity than I did. And I didn't see what the way of escape was. That doesn't mean it wasn't there. And that doesn't mean that it was greater than I could bear, or so I thought. And yet here I am years later, and I can look back and say, well, I guess the way of escape was there. I guess I was able to bear it, and now I can see it. I couldn't at the time because it was so cloudy and so difficult from that particular trial. So we find then that God will allow us to find a purpose in the trial. I think it was a John Wayne quote, and this is not a Holy Scripture quote when I say John Wayne here. It says, and I think it was something like, life is hard. It's even harder if you're stupid. And so I thought of that from time to time when I screw up, and I'm saying, I got to do like my dad said, make a different mistake next time. Let's go into James chapter 1 and verse 3. James 1:3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Well, patience is listed in Galatians 5:22 as what? Is one of the fruit of the Spirit. And there are others in there as well. The Amplified Bible says, be assured and understand that the trial and proving of your faith bring out endurance and steadfastness and patience. Now, I don't know about you, but I would personally just rather have patience granted to me rather than have the trial that forces me to learn the patience the hard way. And that hasn't happened very often that I can think of. It's probably happened and I just don't appreciate it, didn't recognize it. So I would ask you all to be very careful when you pray for patience, because you may be given the trial that will help you to develop the patience. So when you ask for patience, the testing of your faith, knowing the testing of your faith produces patience, it's a really awkward scene to have your faith tested in order to produce patience and to establish your patience. So when you pray for that fruit and the strengthening of your faith, ask that it be gently, done gently and with much mercy, so that you'll carry fewer battle scars and you can learn. You know, there's several ways to learn, and one of them is to learn by reading, and another one is by observing others. And or you could make the mistake for yourself. And the first two are much easier to bear. Then, of course, we have this concept of faith, and the word faith, the testing of your faith produces patience. The Greek word pistis, which is Strong's 4102, refers to the conviction of the truth of anything. So you're being convicted. It's in your mind. It's determination that that is true. You have faith in it. In the New Testament, it's a conviction or a belief that had respect to a man's relationship to God and divine things. So if you have faith in God, then you have then the conviction of the truth of God. It's in you. You believe it. It's a firm conviction. In the times of pressure is when our faith often will be our true, whether our faith, the true colors or the strength of our faith will be seen. And so this testing of your faith is done because of the trials or the temptations, because how else would you necessarily show your faith if there weren't this awkward situation that you've been faced with? Finally, the patience, the reward, the testing of our faith results in then a gift of patience. Remember, it's the fruit of the Spirit that patience is developing. It's defined as steadfast, constant, and enduring. It's the calm endurance of annoyance or delay. Ever try that in a traffic jam? How about in New York City when the light turns green? They say that's the definition of a tenth of a second. When the light turns green in front of you and the cab behind you honks its horn. Not a lot of patience. And we see that whether it's on the highway and you see it's crammed up and you don't know. Is it going to be 2 minutes? 5 minutes? 35 minutes? I don't think I'm the only one out here on I-49 that's been sitting there wondering how long it will be before I can exit to the nearest bathroom. So patience is the calm endurance of annoyance or delay. Let's move on to verse 4 in James chapter 1, verse 4. But let patience have its perfect work, that you may be complete, lacking nothing. I don't know about you, but when I read the word perfect, I think of something that's, you know, that there's no flaws in it whatsoever. That isn't quite what we're looking at here in the sense of flawness. It's really more completeness. Let the patience have its perfect work. This is where it's complete, where a person isn't swayed doesn't deviate from their sense of purpose or loyalty to the faith that they have. One who endures here is blessed. We read that in Hebrews 10, verses 36 through 38. Patience, then, is the allowance of an unknown amount of time to pass in order to let something have its proper and perfect outcome. Ouch. An unknown amount of time to pass in order to have something, to let something have its proper and perfect or complete outcome. Well, what that means is that the outcome is complete. It doesn't lack anything. The King James Version says, but let patience have her perfect work, that ye may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So this whole concept of perfect and complete, perfect in the Strong simply means brought to its end or finished, wanting nothing to its completeness, having reached the end. So it being a perfect means referring to a completed trial that a person is going through. So that's what brings about the patience. Now, we have trials that are ongoing, don't we? And sometimes they seem like they're never going to go away. And we have the apostles. Some of those had too. They were ongoing from time to time. And it seems so incomplete. And so their ability or their growth and their learning was continuous. There's a story of Jesus and the rich young ruler in Matthew 19. In verse 16, Christ says, if you want to be perfect, go and sell all you have and give to the poor, and you'll have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. Well, then the trial for the rich young ruler would be to sell his possessions and giving up everything to follow Christ. Well, here, when it says perfect, it could be translated as entire or complete. It's from the Greek word in Strong's 3648 that means complete, entire, whole, in every part, nothing wanting, the development of every grace into maturity. So, bearing in mind that you may be perfect and complete, lacking nothing, is really quite a statement that this trial will be over with. Okay, it's done, it's finished, it's complete, and then that we, of course, if we don't learn the lesson, will it ever be over with? You know, then we get to do it again. It's like touching the hot stove. How many times do we want to do that? Well, I guess some of us like to touch the hot stove in rhetorically in other ways, over and over again. And I'm learning not to do that as much as I can, especially when it considers poison ivy. Still learning on that one. Then we're going to go to verse 5 in James 1 and verse 5. If any of you lacks wisdom, I think this was written for me, maybe my father inspired this to be written for me, or for me to read this. The concept of wisdom, now you have to bear in mind this is being written to the 12 tribes that are scattered everywhere. And there are also non-Jewish people or Gentiles reading the letter, as well as the other tribes of Israel, and hearing the teaching. And so you'd have men and women, you'd have Jews, Gentiles, other Israelites, and then at that time, slave people and free people. So you had quite a variety of people that were hearing this. And so this concept of lacking wisdom goes back, we read often in Proverbs 4, verses 5 through 9, it talks about get wisdom, get understanding. Well, the Greek word that we're reading about here in James is Strong's 4678, means to be given insight into the nature of things as acquired by acuteness or experience. And then it goes through and says there are many benefits of obtaining wisdom. It's a defense. Well, that's true. You better know not to walk in a dark alley in a bad part of town, right? That's wisdom. It gives us a defense. It gives life, truth, and understanding. And it searches for truth, shows the purpose, helps understand the purpose of redemption. So having wisdom, being able to make a decision based on the insight due to the nature of things. And there are times when we say, I wish I wouldn't have done that. Or, wow, I'm sure glad I did that. The New Bible Dictionary gives the following comment on wisdom. Wisdom is essential not only for leaders of the church in Acts 6:3, but for all believers that they may perceive God's purposes in redemption, Ephesians 1:8-9, and may walk worthily of God and discreetly before unbelievers. Noah Webster in 1828 wrote this about wisdom and its use. If wisdom is to be considered as a faculty of the mind, it is the faculty of discerning or judging what is just, proper, and useful. Wisdom is the sound judgment either in avoiding evils or tempting God. In scripture, theology, wisdom is true religion. Godliness, piety, the knowledge and fear of God, and the sincere and uniform obedience to his commands. This is the wisdom that is from above. Now that's Noah Webster in 1828. And I think people would be well to read Noah Webster, because that definition I do not believe is in the modern dictionary for wisdom, because they leave out God. And we go on continuing on in verse 5, if any lacks wisdom, and I think we can all raise our hands there, then what does it say? And we'll finish up here with in verse, we'll try to finish this up soon here. In chapter 1, verse 5, let him ask of God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it shall be given to him. Whoa, let him ask of God who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it shall be given to him. First of all, who do you ask? Well, you ask God. You can ask your neighbor. You know, if a teenager, beg pardon for the teenagers present, will accept your company there. But from my observation, when teenagers want to find out something, where do they often go to? Other teenagers, right? Because that, and that's their world. That's where they seek out their wisdom from. And where do we go? Other places too. But it's suggesting here, not suggesting, but telling us, let's ask God. Because God is going to give us this wisdom. And because the wisdom, true wisdom, comes from the Father, and we're given every opportunity to ask it. So we should ask God. And we go through over and over again throughout the Bible that people who are willing to ask for wisdom, God will grant them, however incrementally. I know Solomon asked for wisdom when he could have had riches and everything else, and God granted him wisdom. In 2 Chronicles 1:10, Daniel and his companions asked God when they wanted to know the secret of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. So they knew where to go to get wisdom, to get understanding, to get that insight. So first of all, we're going to ask God. And then it says, God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach. Well, God is a giving God. The word used for liberally is from the Greek word haplo, Strong's 574, and defined in vines by being liberally with singleness of heart. It comes from the root word, which is literally defined as simply, openly, frankly, or sincerely. So we can conclude that when we ask God for wisdom, it's with singleness of heart, or an unwavering desire to simply pour out his wisdom on those who ask. It's not complicated. God wants to do this. He wants to give this to us. And then it says, finishing up in verse 5, it shall be given to him. Well, it's by faith then we receive the wisdom. If we ask God, and God's desire is for his children to receive good gifts, and he promises to fill those requests. Verse 6, James 1, verse 6, but let him ask in faith with no doubting, for he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. Now, the undoubting faith is a necessary link to a healthy relationship with God. Because without faith, and we read in Hebrews 11:6, there are two keys to the working of faith that pleases God. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. I was reading a news article, and under the news articles online, they have people that can make comments on it. And somebody was making a comment, and he was mocking God. And when somebody said, well, made a comment about honoring and respecting the Bible, and so the mocker says, well, if there really is a sky daddy, you know, it comes into this kind of phrase. And I'm thinking, you know, this is not only the, here was a person of faith, you know, that was offering up and saying we should rely on God and the Word of God. And the other person was trying to make a mockery of that. So we need faith in order to please God. And of course, in order to please God, we have to believe, first of all, that he is, and secondly, that he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. So in order to know that he is, we start out with, of course, in John 1:1 and Genesis 1:1. The Bible doesn't actually say we have to prove the existence of God. They just give the name of God, I am. In other words, it's presuming the existence of God. It's up to man to decide whether or not to believe. And faith is then knowing that God exists. And then, of course, that God is a rewarder of those who seek him. And it's his delight to show him the plans. And, of course, we know of the promises to Abraham and the, you know, that Abraham's seed will be as the sand of the sea or the countless stars. We read that in Genesis 13 and 15. So back to we're asking for wisdom in faith. It's God's delight to show us, to reward us by giving then heavenly wisdom. Because in Matthew 21:22, whatsoever you ask in prayer, believing, you will receive. Well, there requires wisdom to know what to ask for, to know what's understanding, and then the patience to wait for it. And then it talks about somebody who's doubting, like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. Well, I don't know if you've ever been on a boat. I've been on a boat. I've been deep sea fishing. And when you go out across the horizon and you can't see land and you're bobbing on the ocean, and after a while you really don't know which way is up, especially if you were raised in the Midwest like me and weren't raised with your sea legs, and you doubt your own sanity, and you don't know which way is north, south, east, or west if you're out on the water. It's water in every direction. The waves come at different angles. And I had no idea how people could do this. I didn't even know which way was up and which way was down after a while when you start to getting sick. And there were other guys that were with me were hanging over the railing on the boat, contributing to the depth of the ocean. And so when I got back to land, it was a 3-hour ride back home. And I had caught a ride with, I think, five of us in a little Toyota pickup truck. There were barely room for three in the front, and two of us illegally were in the back. I'm laying in a mattress on the back of a little pickup truck. I've just been ocean fishing. I don't know which way is up, and I'm laying on the floor of this mattress, and I'm bobbling around. It took 3 days before the bobbling stopped, before that sensation stopped. And I can see here, when doubts are like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind, sometimes it's just a little wave. Oops, like, you know, like the wave came to the shore. Sometimes it's a bigger wave. Sometimes the waves are white caps. Sometimes, even after you're off the sea, the waves keep coming and going in the day. And we've all had doubts. That's human, to have doubts from time to time. But what happens is your James is comparing here the doubting, meaning being unstable, like the sea is not stable. It's always at a different level. And so the believer needs to be sure and steadfast and confident in God. Because the surface of the sea never has the exact same appearance twice because of the waves that are coming. And it's also changing according to the wind, and the wind changes and the current changes. And so a doubting person or a divided person doesn't really have a fixed belief system. They're not secure, and so they don't have an anchor. And so they sway in the wind. Wherever the wind blows, if different doctrines or circumstances come about, they change with the wind. So the faith in God has to be firm and unwavering, has to be a solid anchor into the truth, and that way, and confident in the faith in God. I'm going to close it here today at James 1, verse 6, and we'll continue on through next time when we move on from James.